All right. So how many of you were with me yesterday morning? Okay, about half of you in there. Okay. So I didn't run you off. That's interesting. I thought there wouldn't be any after that. So we're going to talk a little bit about... So yesterday, for those of you that were with me there, we talked about market cycles and how things change, right? And different asset classes change at different times. And one of the things that I had mentioned was that when somebody says, so how's real estate? That's really an unanswerable question because there is not enough context behind it. What you should be asking is, well, how is single family housing in your current market? Or how is apartment complex investing where you're investing? And so forth, because the answer is going to be different per asset class. Well, today I'm going to shift it up a little bit and we're going to talk about the credit market. And again, I'm very specific in my wording, so we're going to only talk about the credit market as it relates to investor loans. Not a loan on your home, a homeowner mortgage. We're not going to talk about that at all because I don't really have any expertise in that. I don't do that. So I really can't speak to that. But when it comes to investor or business purpose loans, as we call them, or hard money loans, as you might also refer to them as, that I do have some experience in. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. Now, just by a show of hands, and by the way, if you're just coming in and you have a lunch ticket, come on up front. We still have your lunch for you right up front here. So by a show of hands, how many of you have noticed in your working in real estate that the credit market is changing a little bit on investor loans? Hold them high because I want to see. Oh my gosh. Keep them up. Now, everybody look around at how many people have already experienced what we're going to talk about today, okay? So, I started just a little bit early, so I'm kind of stalling before I start the slides. I'm 2 minutes early yet. So, a lot of you have experienced a change in the credit market. So, let me ask a follow-up to that. Is there anybody, and I doubt that I'll see any hands, that is finding it easier to get loans right now for your real estate project? Okay, for those of you up front, there's no hands up. So then I would take that to believe that you've all found it harder to get lending for your real estate projects. Yes?
Or more expensive.
Okay. So let's talk about that and divide that. How many have found it harder to get a loan? 1, 2, 3, 4, keep them up. 1, 2, 3. Okay, yeah, now we got more coming up. So about 10 or so. I know the expense part. I get that. We all get that. But what we're going to talk about today is not the expense side of that equation. We're going to talk about the availability side of the equation. Because that is the one that can put you out of business. As a real estate investor, availability of capital to do your deals, that's your lifeblood. Would you agree? Without capital, you don't do deals, right? None of us have that deep a pocket that we can just do massive amounts of real estate transactions with our own money. So availability of capital, that's what we're going to talk about and how that is changing. And we are at 12:30 exact, so I'm going to go ahead and get started. The disclaimer, as always, this is not any form of advice. I'm just giving you my thoughts, especially today. The last line is the most important. This is simply my opinion. Everything today is opinion. Yesterday, I was basing everything on fact. Actual things that have happened, and I was sharing with you what had happened with facts. Today, no facts, just opinion. So I want to make that very clear. I could be totally wrong in what I'm going to share with you. I don't think I am, because I've been in this for 17 years in real estate full-time, and 10 years as a financial planner prior to that. So let's talk about money and where it comes from for us to do real estate transactions. These are the bulk of the places money comes from. Private investor capital, as I shared yesterday, My wife and I did over $18 million worth of transactions in our first 5 years in real estate, and we used $1,000 of our own money. The other $17 million, and whatever that comes out to, was private capital. We used no banks, we used no hard money lenders, we used no other source other than private capital. Now, that private capital took a few forms. Sometimes that private capital was, hey, you got some money in your IRA? You know what? I got this deal on an apartment building over here. You put money with it, you know, I can pay you X percent, or you put money with me and I'll give you a certain percentage of the deal, put you in as a partner. You know, that form was part of it. It might have been, hey, you want to sell your apartment complex? Man, things are tough right now. I probably wouldn't be able to get a loan on it. And it looks like hell. I know I wouldn't get a loan. Nobody's going to lend on it. But I tell you what, if you take terms and let me make payments to you, I can make this deal work, right? So that's another form of private capital we call what? Seller financing, right? Then there is subject to, which is also another form of seller financing, which is private capital. I'm just using their credit instead of their money. Okay? So there's a lot of ways we can slice and dice private investor capital, but it all is private investor capital. The next one is real estate note funds. If you go through the hallway out here, you will find no less than four private note funds that are available for you to invest your money in. One of them I'm very familiar with because it's mine, okay? But there are others here as well. Those note funds are another form of private investor capital. They're just pooling that capital to be able to lend it out to real estate investors, okay? So that's where money comes from to do our deals. Then we have small insurance companies. This is less known about. Most people don't realize that insurers, they make more money on the money than they do on the insurance premiums. Insurance companies typically will price their premiums at break-even. Their profit comes from what they do with those premiums they charge you. So they're really an investment firm. They're aggregating capital through something called premiums that we pay them on a monthly basis, and then they take that capital and they go invest it for profit, okay? Well, a lot of them like real estate notes. A lot of them like real estate. So a lot of them provide money to our space for the deals that we do. Local bank lines of credit. This is one of the biggest ones. And until 10 years ago, it was the biggest one. That's why it's in yellow. What most hard money lenders would do is they would go to a local bank and say, hey, I've got $2 million. I want to start a lending company. I got $2 million of my own capital that I've put together, and I need you to leverage me. And the bank would typically say, okay, well, we'll do 3-1. You've got $2 million. We'll give you another $6 million. Now you've got $8 million to start your lending company. And off they go. They get that out on the street. They show a good performance. They show a low foreclosure rate. They go back to the bank. Hey, now I've got $4 million of my own money in. Can you up my credit line? And off we go. Now they've got more money to go out and lend to you on your real estate deals. This is the old model. And this model has been run for decades. But then, about 10 years ago, a new model came on. And that's the last one. Wall Street credit facilities and securitizations. Now in this model, and this has become very, very prevalent, in this model, big lending companies will spin up, most generally on the coasts, and they will use Wall Street lines of credit, which are called credit facilities, instead of a credit line. I don't know why they have to be different, but it's the same darn thing. But they're a very short-term loan to that lender from Wall Street. Most generally, it's a 10-day loan. So they'll give them multi-millions of dollars for 10 days. They go out, they lend it, they get it out on the street as fast as they can, they bundle those package of notes, and then they sell that package on Wall Street as a securitization. Okay? Over the last 10 years, that has become the biggest source of capital in our space. The Wall Street money. And it's cheap. That's why everybody has flocked to it. You go to one of the local hard money guys who does it the old way, he's going to charge you 12 and 2 or, you know, 12 and 3, right? 12% interest and 3 points or whatever it is. Some variation very close to that. Where these other firms using the Wall Street money, heck, they're doing fix and flip loans at 7.99 and 2 points because they're getting their money so cheap. Okay? Now, they're not doing that today. So those of you that got a big grin, sorry, that's over. But up until a couple of years ago, they were certainly doing that. You could get an 8% and a couple of points easily on a fix and flip loan from some of the big major players on the coasts. And a lot of them were squeezing the local guys out because of price. Where are you going to go? Sure, you're going to go wherever it's cheaper, right? But I'm going to make an argument today that this might be a time that you want to go back to the local guys. I'm going to make an argument for that, whether I'm right or not. So, in good times, everybody wants in on the fun, right? Consider this. Single-family real estate prices have been rising uninterrupted since December, roughly, depending on the market you're in. It could be different than that. But on a national level, since December of 2009, when it bottomed and started to go back up again. That is 14 years straight of price gains. How many of you believe that that can just go on forever? Raise your hand. Yeah, nobody wants to take that bet. Okay. You'd be right. It can't. At no time in history has a commodity just went up. At no time in history. So most of the people in lending and real estate investing have never seen a downturn. That's a scary thought. We were talking before about some people that we both know that are syndicators of apartment complexes. You realize most of the people out there raising capital for syndications have never seen a downturn? That should scare you. That should scare you. Yeah. Most of them have only seen an up market. Okay? It is very easy to get complacent and think it can't happen again. That bad things can't happen. It's been great for so long. We have very short memories when it comes to cycles. Very short memories. But all things cycle. They all cycle, including credit availability. So, what could trigger a pullback in the investor credit market? I got somebody yesterday in my thing said, well, I heard that we are, as a nation, 1.6 million homes short of having enough housing for everybody. So prices can't possibly go down. Now, that's a good argument. That's a very good argument. And by the way, he's stating fact. I've read that same statistic over and over and over. We're 1.6 short, 1.5 short, 1.8 short, but somewhere in that ballpark short. Why are we that short? Because demand is high. Demand is extremely high. But what could change, and how would things change if demand stopped? You want to not be short houses real quick? Take away the demand. Now all of a sudden you're not 1.6 million short, are you? Now all of a sudden you're at par. So what could make that happen? Recession could certainly do it. And you say, Tom, people still have to have a place to live. They do. But they don't have to have their own home. What happened in 2008 and 2009? Does anybody remember? Yes. Combination families started moving in under one roof. Yeah. Mom and dad moved in with the son and his family. Or the daughter, who was living on her own in an apartment, moved back with mom and dad. And families started going back in together, and all of a sudden, demand was gone. Real quick. So it can happen. I'm not saying it will. I'm not predicting it will. These are not predictions. But my job in my family and in my company as CEO is to look for the risks and look and find the blind spots. What could hit us? What could hurt us? And then plan ahead for, okay, how do we prevent this? How do we get ahead of that? How do we hedge for this? And that's all I'm sharing with you. It's just some hedges today. Continued inflation. That could hurt us. That could hurt demand because that's going to keep interest rates high. They may go higher. And they may stay higher for longer. If that happened, that's going to drive some demand for sure. Here's one that nobody's talking about. What if we enter a period of stagflation? Now, there's some people in here with hair that's gray. You all have seen that, just like I did, right? Back in the 70s. What is stagflation? High unemployment along with recession and high interest rates. That's the trifecta. That's the trifecta. You think that would hurt demand? High unemployment, interest rates, and recession all at the same time.
Well, and you still had inflation during all of that.
Yes, you did. Until Volcker, Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, squashed it by raising interest rates so that your 30-year mortgage on your home that you live in was 18% at the peak. Go back and check that out. December 79, the 30-year mortgage average was 18%. Yes. Inflation, the three things, recession, unemployment.
So for unemployment, where do you see unemployment right now? And then also, depending on where it is right now, what do you think could happen in the future to affect unemployment as where we are right now?
So right now, unemployment is at historically low rates. Now, yesterday it did tick up a little bit. If you read the report that came out yesterday, it did tick up a notch. They were at 3.9 or 4% right now nationally, but that is still historically low. So on the outside, everything looks like everything's good, except interest rates. Right? We would agree we don't like that. But right now, everything looks like it is good. I just want to try to give you another perspective to say, what if everything isn't as good as it seems? Okay? What I think our biggest blind spot is black swans. Black swan events are things that nobody could have foreseen. So what could be a black swan? Well, COVID was a black swan. COVID was certainly a black swan. Nobody saw that coming, right? War. That would be a black swan. A terror attack. That would be a black swan. There are hundreds and hundreds of other unforeseen events that could happen. I'll get to questions here in a minute. Those are called black swan events. Those are things that we can't sit here and predict. We can't prepare for, even. So the question isn't, do we think any of these things are going to happen? The question is, when something happens, how are we prepared for it? Does that make sense? And the something that we're talking about today in this particular context is, how do we keep capital available to us as real estate investors? Because understand, when there is chaos, there is wealth to be made. Don't think this is a doom and gloom speech. It's not. This is not a doom and gloom at all. In fact, when there is chaos in a market, it's called market disruption. When there is market disruption, there is a lot of money to be made for those that are prepared. That's what I want you to be. I want you to be prepared. And the biggest preparation that we have to have is capital. So who's the first capital source that's going to bail if and when something happens? Local banks, absolutely. Local banks. They are the most conservative of that list up there. They are afraid to own a piece of property. My first few flips that I did in Ohio with a business partner, we used a little bank in New Philadelphia, Ohio, and Marty was the bank manager, and he had been the bank manager there for 11 years prior to us meeting him and doing business with him. And I remember him bragging that he had never had a foreclosure in 11 years as bank manager. That's how risk-resistant they are. They'll be the first ones to flee. Well, how does that affect you? Well, if you're using a lending source that gets their money from local bank lines, guess what? Your source just dried up. Your source just dried up. It's gone. Who bails out next? It's a toss-up, I think. It's a toss-up between Wall Street and the insurance companies. The insurance companies won't go first. They're not going to go until they see foreclosures racking up on their notes. Same thing with Wall Street, because neither of them would know what to do with the property. It's a flawed model. You should not be in lending unless what? Yeah, and you don't mind owning the asset. Exactly. You know, that's a simple rule. I understand with every single loan we write in our lending company that there is a chance that we will end up with that asset. If that keeps me awake, I shouldn't do the loan. I shouldn't do the loan. I should deny it and move on. Now, if it doesn't keep me awake, then I should probably go ahead and do the loan. I know it's a little more complex than that. I'm oversimplifying, but you get the idea. What is an insurance company going to do with houses? They wouldn't know what to do with them. Absolutely not. We have an insurance company that we work with, but we actually backstop their losses. We, in our agreement with them, they'll buy notes from us, but if the note goes to default, we automatically buy it back at par. And then we work it out. Because they don't want that hassle. Wall Street, what's somebody in Manhattan going to do with houses in Cincinnati, Ohio? Or anywhere else across the country? They're national lenders. They lend in every state, practically. They're not going to be able to manage that. So they're going to bolt, and they're going to bolt quickly. So who's left in the space? The private investor capital and the real estate note funds that are what? Private investor capital. That's all that's going to be left. And have we seen this play out before? How many of you were investing in real estate in 2008? Okay. Those of you that raised your hands, did you not see credit dry up even for us? I know credit dried up for people to go get a 30-year mortgage to buy a home to live in. That's a whole different product. The money comes from a whole different place. We're not talking about that. But money also dried up in our space because hard money lenders that were using bank lines that had gotten pulled, they didn't have capital. Other hard money lenders that were using Wall Street lines were getting their lines jerked. One in particular in Houston was the largest lender in Houston. They lent in multiple states across the country. They went out of business overnight. Caused 350 foreclosures. Because a guy in Manhattan made a phone call to a guy in Houston and said, "We're pulling your line today." And the owner of that hard money lending company is a friend of mine today. We sat one day, we were both speaking on a stage later that day. We were sitting in the hallway, and he's like, "Did you ever hear the story of how we lost our company?" I said, "No." He's like, "You want to?" I'm like, "Heck yeah." Because I could learn something from it, probably, right? And what I learned was he had a $35 million line from a company in New York. And one day the board made a decision, a phone call was made, and he was out of business. and lost everything. Lost everything. So we've seen this happen before. We've seen this happen before. This is not something I'm predicting that is going to happen tomorrow or a week from now or a year from now. I don't know. But what I do know is history repeats itself and things cycle. So just be prepared. So what should I be doing now if I were you? And then I'm going to open it up and we'll have a little dialogue with the time we have left. You should be learning to raise private money on your own. That's what you should be doing. And then you're beholden to no one. That's what I did when we started. We used Marty, that banker, for a few deals in 2004. And then when I went full-time in real estate in 2007, I never used a bank or a hard money lender. I learned to go raise private capital. Now, I don't have anything to sell you. I don't have any program on raising money or anything. I'm just telling you that is what saved me, and that's what put me on track to be where we are today. And if I could give any newer investor or somebody that's been around and just wants to take it to the next level, one little bit of advice that I think would be the biggest advice they could have, it's learn to raise private capital. And short of doing that, or while you're doing that, the second thing you should do, and this is a little self-serving, and I understand that, is do deals with hard money lenders that aren't using lines from Wall Street or banks. Go do some deals now. Even though you could get the money elsewhere, even though you could save 1% or 2% or a point or whatever you could save, I'm telling you it is money well spent to go do deals with the guys that are going to be around when the other ones are gone. Because who's going to get first dibs on the capital? The current customers that have a relationship and a track record. Track record and relationship is everything in our business, in the lending business. I'm trying to give you a glimpse at the business from the other side right now. Yesterday, I had a phone call from our quality control department, which is a arm of my legal department. And yeah, I get a call. They're like, we're flagging a file. I said, okay, what's the file? They tell me. I said, what's the problem? They're like, we don't know that there's a problem. There are just some things that seem odd, seem off. And if any of my department heads see something off, that should be flagged. And then it comes to me. Then I hear all sides. And then I make the decision. That way, nobody's head's on a chopping block but mine, right? So they told me their thoughts. They told me their problems. I immediately go back and talk to Natalie. She's head of our origination department. I said, hey, I bet you know this file inside and out, so tell me the scoop. Why'd you like it? What did you see about it? She explains. She's like, man, this guy's got a track record with us. Want to see the last deal he did? She goes into our system, pulls it up, shows me pictures, shows me what it sold for way more than what it appraised for. She's like, yeah, it was kind of odd, but you know what? With this guy, I ain't worried about it. I'm like, yep, me neither. Approved. And it closes Monday. Why? Track record. Track record. Start building that track record now. Before you need it, and then when you do need it, it'll be there for you. All right, I've set the stage. Now let's have a discussion. I had somebody back here had a question, and I said we'd ask them in a minute. Okay, well, let's do one. We'll go around, and if I got time, I'll come back for a second one. I'm not even stepping and wading into that. That has nothing to do with this discussion. It is. They have a double mandate. The Federal Reserve has two mandates. Keep inflation at the prescribed level, which our current Fed chairman says is less than 2%, and keep full employment simultaneously. We have what is considered full employment because less than 5% is considered full. We've been full forever, for a long to long time. But inflation got out of hand. My opinion, the Fed waited way too long, and they acted too tepidly when inflation started entrenching, and that's why we still have inflation. That's just an opinion. Just an opinion. I have no college degree. These guys went to really smart, big, fancy schools. So who am I to who am I to judge? They did. It's kind of common sense. If you keep interest rates at zero, meaning you will give anybody money that qualifies to have money, they're going to pay more and more and more for assets, and asset prices are going to inflate. Why do you think commercial assets were trading at a 4 cap or a 3.5 cap in California? Because money was free. Money was literally free. Yes, sir. Economic global shutdown.
Like COVID. In the history of the Federal Reserve, have we ever had an economic global shutdown?
Never. Never.
So why is interest rate still our go-to solution for a problem we've never had before?
Yep. Answer that question. But since I don't have a crystal ball, I can't answer that question. His question was, when is the crap going to hit the fan? And nobody knows when any of these things are going to happen. That's the whole point. We've just got to prepare as though we know at some point it will. And look, I'm very conservative, so I'm always early. I'm always predicting something bad's going to happen a year before it actually does, you know? And you were there yesterday. When did I start selling off my apartment complexes?
Early.
Or way early, yeah, because I was selling them off in 2018 and 19. Heck, there were people that bought, sold, and bought, sold a third time and made money after I sold. I was early. Yeah, I mean, some of my apartment buildings and complexes traded 3 more times since I had sold them. And I'll have people say, boy, bet you're kicking yourself. No, no, not at all. Not at all. It's going to go down fast. So here's a history lesson for you. I study this stuff more than any man should, really. And I've figured out that the downside of a cycle is only 25% of it. The upside is 75%. The down, when you look at it on a chart, the down is sharp and quick, and then the up is slower and longer term, about 3 times as long. Yeah. Yes.
I have a question as a private lender. You said seek out private capital. When you say that for borrowers or investors, are you telling them to police terms, or what kind of terms should these people be expecting when they raise private capital?
So raising private money, I've had this question for a decade, because I used to teach a class on it years ago when I owned a RIA in Houston. And the answer is, there is no price. It's all negotiable. When I first started raising money, I'll never forget my first private lender. I met at a RIA group in Houston, and his name was Carl, and Carl was charging me 15% in 3 points. And some of you are like, phew, I'd have never done business with Carl. Well, Carl got me on the road. I had no track record. I had no money. I had no credit. I had no job. I had no experience. I should expect to pay a high rate. I should expect to pay a lot, and I did. But
also for, to seek out lenders that are running their money, not going out.
That's right. That's exactly right.
A balance sheet lender,
or a portfolio manager, or a portfolio manager, or a fund.
Yeah, when you get into funded or multi-portfolios, that's when the funds are coming in from the outside, and that's where this lending industry is starting to really...
Starting to show cracks.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is.
I meet with about 11 guys, 12 guys across the country every 90 days, and interest rates are going up.
Yeah.
The loaning numbers are going up. So the 2 and 10s, as we just said in our meeting, there is no 8% money out there anymore.
Nope.
In private lending.
Nope. So I meet with bankers because we buy shopping centers too. In addition to lending, we buy shopping centers for our portfolio. And I sat with 3 bankers in the last 3 months. All of them are like, yeah, man, bring us those shopping centers. We want those deals. And we're like, how much are we talking? And they all quoted us 8.5%. These bankers don't know each other. They didn't talk that morning, okay? But they all quoted us 8.5%. I'm like, guys, okay, we're not doing that. We're just not doing that, okay? Because I've got an insurance company that'll do it for 7.25 to 7.5.
Yeah.
So who am I going to use? I'm going to use the insurance company. It can be. A lot of people in this room, all you need is 2 Carls to launch you. Carl did my first 5 loans on my first 5 flips. And then I stopped using him. And he called me one day. He says, "You mad at me?" I said, "No, Carl, why would I be mad at you?" "Well, you ain't called me for money. And I know you're doing deals." I said, "Yes, sir, I am." He's like, "Well..." I'm like, "Well, you're going to put me on the spot here. I'm going to tell you, and I'm going to be honest. I got another guy that came up to me at the meeting, and he's offering me money at less money. And, you know, I'm obviously..." He's like, "How much?" I said, "He's only charging me 12 and 2. He's like, "All right." I said, "All right, what?" He's like, "I'll do it. I'll do 12 and 2. I'm like, "Well, crap, I should have asked earlier, you know. But I told him, I'm like, "Look, why would you do that? Because I know there's newbies at the meeting that'll pay you. You're 15 and 3. There are." He's like, "Because Melissa don't never miss a check, my wife." I said, "Oh, I'm the devil you know." He's like, "That's right. You're the devil I know." And he said, "Your wife don't miss a check." Okay, I learned something. So, boy, we made sure from that moment on, we don't pay on time. We paid weeks early. Every lender, weeks early. Always, always early. And when we went back, if they had money, guess what? We got it. We were never turned down. Yes, sir.
So I'm Uncle Bob. This is my wife, Aunt Millie.
Good, good. Now, there's the problem. There's the problem. So, in 2014 or 15, we came out with a loan at our company called the long-term loan because I'm very creative. I didn't know what else to call it. The long-term loan. We had a 20-year, we had a 30-year, and then we had a 20-year with a 5-year balloon. And the 5-year ballooned one was cheaper, and then the 20 was next, and the 30 was a little more. There was probably a half a point spread between them. Nobody in the country had this product that I know of, and I travel everywhere. Then, a few years later, the industry came out with something that looked very similar called the DSCR loan. I'm like, what the hell? They ain't very creative either. I don't even know what that is. I had to look it up. The DSCR loan became very popular, right? And that was the debt service coverage ratio loan that you could use. You could go out, use the hard money or the fix and flip loan, get the thing fixed up, and then refinance it into the long-term DSCR for a hold, for a short-term rental, long-term rental, whatever you're going to do with it. I had Pure Street Financial in California and another company, I can't remember their name, called us to get our advice on setting up their DSCR loan programs because we had 2 years of history already with that product. And I told them how to set it up, how we set ours up, and neither of them took our advice. Nobody else ever asked. And I said the way they are doing it is not a full cycle product. It's not a full cycle product. This product only works in an up market. As soon as the market starts teetering, product's gone. And that's where I think we are almost there right now. So when we're doing our fix and flip loans, our short term, we are very interested in what their plan is on the back end, because the environment could be completely different in 6 months, 9 months, whenever they get this project finished, than it is today. And we have to plan for what it could be like, not what it is like. So that is a very valid worry. Now, we don't worry about it a lot because we still have our long-term product. So if our guys get in a jam and they can't refi it anywhere else, as long as we like the deal going in, we can refinance them and put it in our other fund, our long-term fund. Because it's all private capital. We don't use bank lines. We don't use Wall Street lines. We have, in our short-term fund, we call it the growth fund, we have $98 million as of last week. So we can just recycle that on fix and flip loans as long as our investors like getting those checks on a monthly basis. Talk to our girls at the table. I can't even answer that question. I don't do the day-to-day. And then in the long-term pool, we've only got about $18 million over there. So we can keep those. We'll do 20 years. We'll do 30 years. We even do a 35 now? Okay. Yeah, we even do a 35-year amortization to get the DSCR to match because rental rates have been challenging to get to the buy price and still have your debt service. So by stretching it out longer, and we don't care because we know how these houses typically will sell in 5 years anyway. It doesn't matter what we amortize. It doesn't matter what the term is. 5 to 8 years, they're gonna come off the books anyway. That's been our running 5 year history that tells us that. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted, are you only converting your, are you for your long term, or is that just to convert your own short term, or do you let others get straight?
No, we have it's published products. Anybody that can go on our website and fill out an application for either of those, any of those loan products. Yep. That's correct. Our loans are all kept in-house.
So then in that case, it's like, you know, let's say if I was doing a rehab loan with you guys, I would it's not like your money's going to run out or something like that. I would have to be worried about if I want to eventually refinance it and like the market is
now. So I would say this. Nobody can guarantee you that they will have money, so I don't want to lead you to that impression, but there's a better chance, yes, because it's all private capital.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. We've never had a month of net outflow of capital, ever. So we always have more new money coming in than anybody redeeming or money going out. But I can't ever say that it couldn't flip the other way, and I say, oh, we got to pause for a minute. We can't do any more of that particular loan for a minute. It could happen. Yes, we only lend in the business-friendly states. And we have a map on our table over there in the back with those all outlined. So, yes, some of you heard through what I said, and others are in an hour or so, that's going to click. All right, I got time for a couple more questions. I didn't want this just to be a big monologue, but I wanted to get a dialogue going with y'all. Yes. Private money comes from Eugene. It comes from people like this.
So they invest in your company then?
They invest in our fund. And then our fund buys our notes that we originate in our lending company.
And you said that when you get private money, like if I got private money.
Right.
Well,
just your private lender, and they're, yeah. But most, back when we were buying houses and apartments, all my private lenders were friends. They didn't start out that way. They were strangers I met in a RIA group like this, okay? But after a while, they became friends. We called each other. One became a really good friend. We've probably done 40 vacations with that couple, my wife and I. They are our best friends to this day. And they started out as our private lender. Now we're just, you know, we're best friends. So are they going to pull the rug out from under you if you're doing your business, regardless of what the market's doing and what's going on around you? No, they're not going to pull your lending as long as they're getting their checks. In fact, they're going to want to give you more because why? They trust you, and they're going to start worrying about other places they have their money that they don't have a stronger relationship with as they do with you. That's what we found. What happens is once you build those relationships, people start funneling more and more and more to you, and they're like, you know what, I don't really know this guy. I don't know about the stock market. I don't know about this. And they start going to what they trust the most, which in our case was us, and in your case could be you. Yes, sir. We are actively buying shopping centers currently, right now. We just started about a year ago finding deals that met our buy box.
But not apartments and not offices.
No, apartments aren't there. Self-storage is not there. And office is too volatile. Numbers don't work in self-storage currently. No, not in my opinion. Again, this is all opinion, just Tom's opinion. Yes, sir, and then I'll come back to you.
Would that self-storage opinion apply in your mind to tertiary
markets,
small
stuff? Look, you can find a deal in any market if you're willing to work hard enough, or if you're just a blind squirrel and, you know, you find an acorn just by accident, you stumble over it, right? Some of my best deals have been because I was a blind squirrel and just stumbled over it, right? So I'm not saying that you can't go out there and find a self-storage or a good apartment deal or anything right now. I'm saying for me to scale that up and put a team in place, it would not make sense because I'm not going to find enough of them to do that. Prices are too expensive in those two categories, yes. They are softening rapidly in office, and they are softening slowly in retail. I mean, I mentioned an office building yesterday. I was at the airport trying to get here the other day, and one of our real estate brokers called and said, hey, I got 132,000 square foot, seven-story glass office building on Westheimer in Houston, which is a main, very prestigious thoroughfare. He's like, I think we can buy it and the parking garage beside it for $4 million. I'm like, okay, what do you want to do with it? He's like, I don't know. What do you want to do with it? I said, get it under contract. Get it under contract quickly. It's an office building. So, yeah, while I'm afraid of office, I ain't afraid of that office, right? So yes, I'm afraid of office right now, but price kills all fear, right? For 132,000 square foot building at $4 million with an adjacent parking garage, yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, yeah, I'd do that. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry. So have I ever done self-storage? Yes, I have. I've done two in the past. I was never big in self-storage, and I don't know a lot about it. So I don't consider myself qualified to talk self-storage, even though we owned a couple of them. And what do you do with an office building you can't fill? You can fill. You fill it. You just have to fill it differently. The days of taking that particular office building I'll use as an example in Houston, the days of having a big national credit company come in and rent three floors of it or two floors or a full floor for $30 a foot or $25 a foot are over. Those days are over. But could you chop that floor into 3,000 square foot, 5,000 square foot, 8,000 square foot spaces and leasing it out to regional or local tenants for $1 a foot? Yeah, and that's what's happening. The success I've seen in office, that's what they're doing. I call it the metamorphosis of the office industry. Rather than renting an entire floor to a company at huge numbers, you're going to have to buy these buildings cheap enough that $1 a foot a month or $12 a foot a year will make you a handsome profit, because that's about what they're going to rent for right now. Mostly small companies. It could be, somebody asked me earlier to give some examples. It might be somebody that wants to put a little hair salon in. It might be an accountant that's been working out of his home for years and he needs to hire an assistant, and his wife says, you need to get an office, right? So he goes out and he gets a little office and he hires an assistant. It's going to be startups and small regional or local tenants typically, not going to be the big national people coming in. No, I don't think it has anything to do with shopping centers.
You were talking yesterday about shopping where there's no shopping.
Yeah.
Those are the kind of people I can see wanting those.
Yeah. So you got to look at the pricing. If I'm, we'll just use the accountant example. If I'm an accountant I want to go into this office building and pay $1 a foot, that's a gross lease. All bills paid pretty much, right? The electric is included. Everything's included for that buck a foot per month. If I go to a shopping center and I get a little space, now I'm going to pay probably $1 a foot there as well, but then I've got to pay my triple nets on top of that. That's probably a 30%, 40% increase. And I got to pay my own utilities. I got to pay for my own repairs and maintenance in my unit. If the AC goes down, I got to take care of that. So there's a big price differential between the two. What will typically happen is they'll start in the office building and they'll get their business up and running, and then they'll get successful enough to move to the shopping center where they have foot traffic and visibility.
Okay.
That would be the advantage to them.
So you actually see the office building as the starting point?
Yes, I see it as the starting point.
Where your location would be, the more exclusive?
No, there's no foot traffic, there's no visibility. You're inside a big glass building.
Okay.
Yep, no benefit to it. It's just a spot. Yep. All right. One more. Yes, sir.
How would you change that around so that you could make the office building more like the strip mall?
I don't know that you can. I haven't figured that one out, but I'll give that one some thought. But I don't know how. Yes. So everybody thinks that retail centers are dead. When I talk about we buy shopping centers, the most common thing is, oh, you haven't heard of this thing called Amazon? Right? I just read a Marcus & Millichap report last night in my room. They put out a quarterly report, and if you're interested in retail space, you should get on that email list. Anybody can get these reports and read them. They're public. It's Marcus & Millichap, which is a big brokerage, but they have different segments. They have a retail section, they have a multifamily section, and so forth. The retail report just came out that nationally, retail is currently at 5% vacancy. 5%. There is virtually none in the pipeline. There's virtually none came online this year. They think vacancy, because of some announcements from CVS, Walgreens, Rite Aid, the pharmacies have been fighting each other. They're going to shut a lot of stores, about 800 and some stores across all three of those companies in the next 12 to 24 months. That's going to bring vacancy up a little bit in retail, because that is a segment of retail, believe it or not. But there's already plans for Dollar General, Family Dollar, and Dollar Tree to take over a lot of those locations, and they're fighting for them. Bye Bye Baby and Bye Bye Baby and Bed Bath & Beyond went belly up and got bought out by Overstock. A lot of those stores, they were fighting and competing to get those leases for Michael's, Hobby Lobby, and another one that was fighting for them. They were actually bidding against each other to take over those extra, those vacated leases. So I am very bullish on retail space because of this and many other things I could spend an hour on. But just study it. It's not scary at all to get into commercial. Start with something small, or partner with somebody, or get into a syndication where you really like the lead or the sponsor and you trust them, and get in with them so that you can get all the quarterly reports. You can get all the video updates of the property. Those are great ways to learn. I've invested in syndications just for the knowledge. I didn't really care if I made money. I mean, obviously I want to, but if I didn't, it was knowledge that I was gaining out of it. Yes? Right. No, it doesn't. It matters the same as if your 401k dipped a little bit and you're 40 years old. Who cares? You're not selling those stocks or mutual funds anytime soon anyway, right? You're waiting for that to go back up. So no, if you've got a short-term drop in value, as long as your lender doesn't have an issue with it and it's not an issue with your covenants of your loan, that would be the only worry I would have. Last one is going to be right here in the back. I'm sorry? $50,000 is the minimum. And I'm not trying to get investments for our fund. Actually, it is only available to accredited investors. I have to make that, now that we're talking about it, I have to say that publicly. And if you want to know what an accredited investor is, see us at the table. We can give you that information. But I just wanted to give you knowledge, try to show you some of the blind spots, and hopefully you'll take that, go out, raise some private capital, maybe work with a hard money company that uses private capital. That is my selfish part in this. We would love to be that private capital company for you. And if you have any questions about our loan product, these two ladies have more knowledge in it than I do, and they are the ones that you'd want to talk to. Thank you very much for sharing your time with me.